This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Ashley Thornburg, and in studio with me is my co-host, Craig Blumenschein.
How are you, Ashley?
I am well. Happy September to you.
It is already September. We're
well into September now. Yeah.
Yeah.
But it's only the second day of our fall member drive, and that is a very exciting time around here. This is your opportunity to be generous, because we rely on generosity. We really would not exist here if our listener members weren't helping to pay
for the bills. That's absolutely true. You couldn't say that any more clearly, and I apologize for interrupting, but it's true.
No.
We would not be here if it were not for...
Never apologize for passion, Craig.
...the pledging support of our listeners, for which we are grateful.
Well, you know, we compare it a lot to a pie, because in the pie chart, it's something like 60%. It's a little over
60%. Significant.
And I'm just thinking, well, that's a lot of pie, and I love pie, but what would I do if I had a lot less pie in my life? You know, it wouldn't be as happy of an existence. And hey, if we didn't have the money that comes from that membership support, we wouldn't be able to do as much around here. We pride ourselves on the programming that is free of commercial influence. That is kind of a double-edged sword when you start to have too many advertisers, too many politicians, too many cooks in the kitchen. They start to tell you what to do. Well, we try to stay more neutral, and that is where you come in as the member.
It is. And we should share with our listeners, Ashley, I know that you have been involved in public media for, what, 15 years or more?
Yes, since 09. Mm-hmm.
Mine is working on year 11 here. And the beauty about doing what we do is we don't have to go to the department upstairs and say, is this okay that we talk about this today? Or do we need to wait?
Right?
Are we not allowed? It's none of that. We have complete editorial freedom for our show, which I greatly appreciate. And I know our listeners do too. And it's only because they support public media here, right here in North Dakota.
Yeah. Yeah, every once in a while I try to micromanage, and believe me, it doesn't go over well. We pride ourselves on this ability that we have the access and the resources that we have to bring you stories that are interesting across the state. We have, of course, national and global news covered for you because of NPR, but then this regional on the ground reporting with people like Dave Thompson, Todd McDonald, we have Danielle Webster, we have Katie, who is reporting out in Bismarck. So whatever is your reason for supporting Prairie Public, these people are here doing this work. Craig and I doing a number of interviews on a weekly basis, trying to get you informed, engaged, and just the ability to get through your day. So whether you're here for weather, energy, the environment, education, commodity prices, floods, those happen occasionally around here, we know that you need good regional, national, international, global, heck, sometimes even intergalactic coverage.
It's coming to that. But Ashley, I've said before that I am so blessed to be a colleague of Dave Thompson.
Mm-hmm.
One word right there, integrity. He is one of North Dakota's most experienced journalists by far, and that should not be lost on our listeners, as there aren't many people who are keeping an eye on the shop anymore around the world, around the country, and also here in North Dakota. Dave is the man. So we hope that you will go right now to prairiepublic.org. Consider making your pledge of support. Coming up right now is my interview that first aired in February with Dr. Scott Acton. He's a wavefront scientist for Ball Aerospace, and he discusses his incredible history with the project and what may be next for him, one of our country's most brilliant physicists. Scott, my friend, welcome to Main Street.
Well, it's good to be here, Craig.
Scott, before we look forward with the James Webb Space Telescope, let's look back a little bit. Tell us your background and how you became involved in the James Webb Space Telescope project.
When I was in second grade, my dad brought home a new television for us. The vertical hold adjustment on the old one was broken, And it was still a black and white TV, but he gave me the old television to take apart and just have fun with. I think he took the picture tube out so I wouldn't electrocute myself. But I just remember being completely enthralled by what I saw inside of that television. You know, back then, this is an old TV. Old television had gears and pulleys and mechanisms and
knobs.
Smells and knobs. And I was hooked from that moment on. As a little boy, I was defined by electronics. I kind of got the reputation of being the neighborhood mad scientist. And I didn't understand any of it, but I could build pretty much anything. It's like cooking. You have a recipe, you have ingredients, you follow the rules. Most of the time, it comes out right. And people would ask me what I was going to be when I grew up, and I said, well, I'll work with electronics, of course, but I had no idea what that meant, so I figured that I would be a TV repairman. I mean, that made sense. You know, a lot of the parts I got for my projects came from old disused televisions, and that was the vision that I had for myself, working for someone that owned a TV repair shop.
Like my dad
and,
did.
Yes, like your father. That's absolutely right. And but then one day I had an experience that changed my life. And my uncle, who was a Methodist minister, was visiting. And we were on the floor of my parents' kitchen playing with a set of dominoes. And he asked me some questions. He said, you know, we weren't playing the game. We were, you know, stacking them up and knocking them down. And he said, what do you think would happen if we pushed these dominoes closer together? You think they'd fall down faster or slower? And we did these little experiments, and he said to me, that's physics, Scott. And I said, physics? What's that? And he said, physics, that's what a physicist does for a living. And I just remember thinking, you mean to tell me there's a job you can get where you do this stuff all day long and get paid for it? And from that moment on, I decided I would become a physicist. And, you know, one thing led to another. I ended up doing my summer jobs out of college at the Lockheed Missiles and Space Company in Palo Alto, California, and got involved with optics. And that led to working with some observatories. And that led to a six-year stay at the Keck Observatory. And that eventually led to JWST in Boulder, Colorado.
You started your career at a community college. You didn't go right out of the gate to MIT or anywhere like that.
That's right. Yes, I right out of high school, I went to Central Wyoming College primarily because, you know, they offered me a scholarship. I think it was maybe $1,500 or so, and it was a very good choice for me. I think a university would have just absolutely kicked my rear end in that moment. You know, usually it's not the intellectual things or the academic things that gives a student right out of high school a hard time. It's more of just handling life, and to be able to be there in a friendly environment and still be with my parents, it was absolutely crucial for me. I did find out after there that I couldn't major in physics. There was a teacher there that taught physics, but he said you have to transfer to a university. And so the next year I did. I went to the University of Wyoming. And from there, I ended up transferring to Texas, where I finished up my education. But Central Wyoming College was a very essential first step in my education.
And here comes now an opportunity. It wasn't yesterday, it wasn't last year, but it was a long time ago with this James Webb Space Telescope idea. How did that come into your life?
Well, I was living in Hawaii with my family, and completed the work I went there to do. I spent 6 years working with the W.M. Keck Observatory. I built the adaptive optics systems for that, which was a really great opportunity and a fun experience for me. But I found myself asking, okay, what do I do next? I always say that I was born in a midlife crisis. I just always had this sense that I needed to accomplish and needed to do things. I've been very driven. And at the time, I thought the really neatest thing to do would be for humanity to put a person on Mars. And I looked around, and politically and economically and sociologically, the window for us to become a spacefaring civilization had closed. It really had. And I wasn't the only one that recognized this. I mean, everybody had. Now, I would say in hindsight that somehow Elon Musk and SpaceX has opened this window up. We are definitely going to go to Mars. But at that point back then, you know, 20 some odd years ago, that was an absolute impossibility. And so I decided that if I could make an impact on this new telescope, which they called back then the Next Generation Space Telescope, that if I could make a significant impact on that, that I would be able to look at the years that I spent on it and feel good about it. So I, in a speculative sense, I wasn't sure who was going to win that contract, but I picked up my family and we moved to Boulder, Colorado. And as it turned out, Ball Aerospace, working with what was TRW at the time, were awarded the contract. So I was in the right place and spent the next 20 years working on this project.
Your role, Scott, was to take these 18 beautiful mirrors. And that number's correct, right? 18?
Yes.
That's in my mind. And once they unfolded, you didn't have anything to do with the launch or its travel there. But here we come. Now the space telescope has cooled down. It's behind this massive umbrella, sunshade, if you will. And these mirrors start to unfold. And here comes you and your role. What did you do?
That's right. Well, basically what I did, and the team that I worked with, you know, credit where credit is due. I had a team of about 15 people who actually, sat on the computer consoles 24 hours a day and clicked the buttons. But basically what we needed to do was take each of those 18 mirror segments and plus the secondary mirror too, which is sort of sits off away from the rest of the telescope, like a normal telescope would. And we had to put those in exactly the right positions. And I'm not talking about millimeters or even microns. I'm talking nanometers, you know, a billionth of a meter.
And the size, Scott, of a virus? Is that an actual
The virus is huge. Virus is huge.
Wow.
It is. Just imagine. I thought a really good analogy is if you pictured North America, you know, the United States as being the primary mirror, and then each of the states as being a mirror segment, the positions we're talking about are the size of an anthill. So it's very, very precise, and it has to be that way because the wavelength of light we're looking at is very, very small. We needed to be a very small fraction of the wavelength of light so that it makes a perfect image. And it sounds impossible, but it's not impossible at all as long as everything is stable. I mean, if you can move a mirror and have it affect the image you form, well, then there's got to be a way that you can look at that image and work out what's wrong and what needs to be fixed. And that's what I spent 20 years figuring out how to do.
And the hardware didn't exist to do that which you were trying to do. Is that right?
Yes, that's absolutely right. We had some general ideas of how to proceed, but there were a number of different technologies on this telescope that had never been demonstrated. One was this deployable sunshield. Another is the micro shutter array, which is used with one of the instruments, which is a spectrograph. So we had to go through a series of steps to do something known as a technology readiness level demonstration. And so as far as my part, we built a scale model of the telescope in a clean room that was completely optical, completely functional in every way. Now, obviously, it wasn't in a vacuum and it wasn't, in a cryogenic environment, but we then developed these algorithms and demonstrated them on this test bed to achieve something known as TRL-6, which means that it has been demonstrated in a flight-like environment. And once we got to that point, then we had enough confidence to proceed with the mission and with building the telescope and ultimately launching it.
Scott, when you are aligning these mirrors in near 0 degrees Kelvin, is that right? Am I getting that scientifically correct? Which is very cold. You can give us a better definition of what that means.
It's almost as cold as North Dakota. I mean, it's getting really close.
That's cold.
Okay.
However, did you use lasers? How were you getting feedback to Earth that you were successful? How did you know it was working? There had to be a moment when you weren't sure, and then you were sure. How did all that come together?
It's very piecemeal. I mean, so the telescope is obviously designed to take images, and we have, 7 different science modes. But one of them in particular, the near-infrared camera, which was built by the University of Arizona and the Lockheed Missiles and Space Company specifically for this mission, they had, they send images down. So on It was in the middle of the night on February 2nd. We pointed the telescope at a part of the sky known as the Large Magellanic Cloud, where there are lots and lots and lots of stars. So that no matter how far off you are, you're going to see something. And we took an image. And we got a big blob of images down because we get an image of the sky from every single segment because they're not looking at the same part of the sky. And from there, then we pointed the telescope over to a single star that was a very bright star and didn't have any other stars nearby. And then we rastered the telescope around, taking images, and then pieced them all together until we saw a picture of 18 individual stars, one for each of those mirror segments. And then we went through some steps where we like set the focus of the telescope, and you could wiggle each of those segments and take an image before and after, so we figured out which spot in the image corresponded to which segment. And then it was just a question of tilting those segments to bring them all in so that we could perform the further analysis on this. Now, as this is done, we're getting images down every day, and we can analyze those to see how we're doing. But it's literally just pulling yourself up by your bootstraps. And eventually, we downloaded an image that was perfect and diffraction limited, and it showed that the telescope was completely aligned, one of the highest resolution images ever taken from space. And the very first image we brought down had 241 galaxies in it. One of those galaxies even showed an ongoing supernova. And when I saw those images for the first time and realized, I just realized that every image that this telescope is going to produce is going to look like the Hubble Ultra Deep Field. If you integrate long enough, you see a galaxy. There's no part of the sky that is dark. The dark sky is a myth. Everywhere you see is a galaxy. And so I suppose for me, when I saw that image with 241 galaxies in it, that's when I knew we were successful.
Where were you?
I was in we set it up a conference room. This is at Space Telescope Science Institute in Baltimore, Maryland. But we set up a conference room and the data processing pipeline such that no human would see the image until we all got to see it. So there was no sneaking and looking at it beforehand. So we were all in this room and projecting the images as they came down onto a big screen. And my wife was there with me, which was really nice at the time she was visiting. And then we displayed this image on the screen, and it was just absolutely magnificent.
Everything that I have read about the James Webb Space Telescope, Scott, tells me that it is exceeding expectations. And I find that interesting because there were hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of fault points along the way, yet here we are with something that is performing beautifully and will last longer than we thought it would. Is that right?
Yeah, absolutely. It had a requirement to last for 5 years. We were predicting 10, but now it looks like it's probably going to last 20 years.
When we look at the images that come down, we're all struck with a sense of it's beautiful. It's just stunning. But I think for many people, that thought maybe ends right there, that, boy, that's just beautiful. But you think of it in a much different way, I presume. What do you see when you see these incredible images that we've come to love?
I always come back to the little rhyme that we would learn as kids, twinkle, twinkle, little star, how I wonder what you are. And we are attracted to the beauty of these images, the beauty of creation. And only then do we ask ourselves the question, why? You know, why are we seeing what we're seeing? Why is it like that? But the initial reaction is one of emotion and one of beauty, of artistic expression. And that's the correct reaction. So I look at those beautiful pictures that everyone else is looking at, and I ask myself, why? And that's what all the astronomers are doing right now. Now, of course, the very first image I saw, which was on February 2nd in the middle of the night, was not a beautiful picture. It was an extremely aberrated image, and I began to ask myself why in a negative sense. And of course, because we need to align the optics. It all comes back. I mean, I love to talk about this subject, Craig. When we look at some of the, before cameras existed, some of the earliest drawings of galaxies that people didn't really know there were galaxies. They called them nebula. And one of them in particular, Lord Rosse, had a telescope that he built himself, and he drew these pictures of the Whirlpool Nebula, these spirals. And when I show this to adults, I say, what does this remind you of? Think 1800s. In general, the adults don't understand, but when I show it to little kids, invariably some little kid will stand up and say, oh, that's Starry Night from Vincent van Gogh. And Vincent van Gogh, I believe anyway, saw some of his drawings, and he was moved by the fact that there were these spiral things in the sky. And that's where he came up with his series of paintings. The most famous one is A Starry Night, that shows this very correct artistic expression of what we see scientifically. So it's hard to not want to bring art and spirituality into this, because they seem to be inseparable, at least from the standpoint of how we experience it as humans.
That's Dr. Scott Acton. We'll have more of that visit, but first, this is our fall membership drive here at Prairie Public. I'm joined by my colleague, Ashley Thornburg. And Ashley, we are here to ask our listeners to consider pledging their support, or to continue pledging their support, to Prairie Public and specifically to Main Street. We do our best to get around the state, and in this case, around the region, to bring listeners a wide variety, a wide spectrum of topics that we think they may like or may make them want to learn more. We go around the state, we go around the region, and we do our best to bring great stories like the one you're listening to with Scott Acton to our listeners.
Well, and in this case, we're even going up into the sky with that space
telescope. Galactic, as you said earlier. Yes.
Yes. You are making all of that possible with your investment in quality programming at prairiepublic.org, or when you call 800-359-4145. That is what sets the tone for everything that you hear. So we have people here. We have journalists who are covering daily news. We have people like Craig and me who are hosts. We are having the longer form conversations. We have music hosts like Mike Olson and Scott Prebis, who just know an incredible amount about the music that they are putting out there. And then we also find these other interesting people. I'm thinking of Tom Ezern and the depth of history knowledge that he has. And oh my gosh,
Jesse
I
Veter.
So look forward, yes, to hearing Jesse's life on the ranch.
Awesome.
And then Sue Balcom and all the tips that she has on every Thursday about food and about gardening and just how much fun she is to listen to, because that's what we're trying to do, is not just keep you informed. We could give you information, but finding people who can explain it clearly so that you really know how to digest this information and understand why it is important to you. I've got biologist Chuck Lura with Natural North Dakota. We have Tom Brousseau and the Great American Folk Show. These are all coming at you locally
here. Dakota
Datebook. Yeah,
Dakota
the Y Datebook. Show. Yeah. these shows are reflective of our roots and really what it means to be of the Prairie region. You are supporting that when you go online to prairiepublic.org or when you call 800-359-4145.
The beauty of this, Ashley, I think, is these are challenging times. There's just no question about it. Things are changing. Life is changing. The way we are producing media is also changing.
Yep.
You're working on a podcast series that will be coming up later. But it's important now more than ever that public radio thrives. And I use that term radio a little loosely, because really, we're coming at you.
Because you don't want to say legacy media?
Maybe not. But people want to listen to us on their time, maybe not necessarily in live radio.
Sure.
And we get that. So right now, prairiepublic.org, go right there and make your pledge of support. Back now to our conversation with Dr. Scott Acton after this news.
Good afternoon. For the Prairie Public Newsroom, I'm Todd McDonald. The director of the North Dakota Transmission Authority says new EPA rules that could lead to the shutdown of coal-fired power plants are moving too quickly and threaten the resilience of the power grid.
There's a lot of people in the industry that feel that we're transitioning or changing the grid on a basis speed that cannot be sustained.
John Weta told the North Dakota Industrial Commission he's been looking at proposed new EPA rules on carbon reduction and ozone.
And basically that shows us crossing the line into weather dependency as early as 2026.
Weta also says North Dakota remains a leader when it comes to carbon capture projects.
But it needs to be built and demonstrated successfully here before other areas are going to actually accept that as a technology that can be utilized.
Governor Doug Burgum chairs the Industrial Commission. He says the headline for the authority's report should be "Cost More, Less Reliable."
Has anybody seriously in the industry thought about making stickers that you put by a light switch that says may or may not work based on the weather in another state?
This year's roadside game brood surveys were conducted in late July and August. The results show pheasant, gray partridge, and sharp-tailed grouse numbers are up in North Dakota. Game and Fish Department upland game biologist R.J. Gross says the survey looks at the number of broods and brood sizes living on the sides of roads driven by surveyors. The number of pheasant broods per 100 miles are up 70%, and the average brood size is up 2%. The final summary is based on 282 survey runs made along 100 brood routes across North Dakota.
The habitat was really good. We had all that moisture from lots of snow. That really brought up the vegetation in the spring, so nesting cover was there. And then, we had good shots of rain, and the insect population was definitely thriving this summer. When the chicks hatch, right around June 10th, it would take a couple days every year is our peak hatch for pheasants in North Dakota. It was near perfect conditions. Everything was lush and green, and there were bugs all over the place for them. So chick survival was really good.
Gross says the bird numbers help game and fish manage populations in the state. Good game bird numbers can be more visitors for the tourism industry. The pheasant season opens October 7th this year and continues through January 7th of 2024. From the Prairie Public Newsroom, I'm Todd McDonald.
We're back on Main Street, and we continue now with Dr. Scott Acton, wavefront scientist for Ball Aerospace, who spent decades working on the James Webb Space Telescope.
Scott, where does this triumph rank in human history relative to science?
Wow, ask me that in 100 years, and I bet you I could answer it.
What are you feeling today
better,
about
but it?
It
strikes me as the most important scientific endeavor that we've ever done. I believe it was probably outdone in terms of human hours by the Great Wall of China, but that's probably it. We 2,000 people worked for 25 years on this to make it happen, and it is literally changing the way we think about the universe. So I think I guess I would have to say this is probably, cautiously say this is probably the most important scientific advancement that humanity has taken.
Give us a sense, Scott. You talked about it briefly earlier. We also know a lot about the Hubble Space Telescope. Many of us know that it wasn't working quite right, and we hopped on a space shuttle, did a spacewalk, and we fixed it. That's not going to happen to this telescope because it's much farther away. Where is it? Give us a sense of its hardware and what will happen next with it. Will it stay in the same spot? Is it in a normal orbit? Where is it?
Well, the telescope is at a magical place called L2, the second Lagrangian point between the Earth-Sun system. So it was kind of a dilemma. I mean, you can't put a telescope just in a low Earth orbit because just the heat from the Earth would warm it up. Remember, this telescope has to be cold. I mean, very cold in order to work. So we put it at a point that's a million miles away from the Earth, but it's a magical point in that it tends to stay there. So if you draw a line between the Sun and the Earth and then go out a million miles further, there is this magical point, which is called the second Lagrangian point, where you can keep a body stationary there with very little effort. So what will happen is we will continue to update its position by firing thrusters until the spacecraft runs out of fuel. in which case it'll eventually drift away and become lost. That's predicted to happen in 20 years, so we've got 20 years of time to do science on this.
Who decides what science is done on the James Webb Space Telescope?
A committee. A committee that was formed, and anyone can submit a proposal. So, you know, even you and I could. And, is you know, they're evaluated on a handful of things, you know, the scientific merit, how appropriate it is for the instrumentation we have, and determined way in advance, and then it's all scheduled. One of the neat things about this is that if you're the astronomer or the scientist that's leading a particular investigation, you get exclusive rights to those images for 6 months. And then it becomes available to anyone in the world who wants to look at them. And even now, like all the wavefront sensing data that I looked at in aligning the telescope, anybody can download those images and have them.
Is this telescope designed to tell us whether life exists elsewhere, to tell us more about the beginning of our existence in the universe, or something else?
Well, I mean, certainly the life thing is a big question, right? And this telescope could certainly tell us if there are atmospheric conditions on a planet near that's orbiting a nearby star that might be favorable for life to exist. It of course doesn't answer that question, you know, until they stand up and wave at you. You don't really know. you know, quite honestly, the simplest way for us to find out how common life is in the universe is to go to Mars, and to see if we can find evidence of fossilized life there. If we don't, that says an awful lot, because Mars had conditions that were suitable for life in the past. And, you know, on the other hand, we may find it. We may find, you know, viruses or bacteria or who knows what. What we're going to have to look for in these other planets are signatures for carbon dioxide, for, you know, even methane in an atmosphere of a nearby planet. And that won't definitively answer it, but it'll come close. The telescope that's to come after this one, you may have heard it called the Louvois or whatever, will have something known as a coronagraph that can take detailed spectra on planets that are orbiting nearby stars, and might actually say, you know, look for something like chlorophyll or something, you know. So I am afraid we're probably not going to answer that particular question with the Webb telescope unless we get very, very lucky. Now, as far as the origins, absolutely. It's already caused us to completely rethink how the early galaxies were formed and evolved. You know, we knew there'd be surprises. Okay, so if the images coming back were mundane, that would be a tremendous surprise. But they're not. They're showing pictures of galaxies that were around only 200 million years after the universe began, that are fully mature galaxies. They look like ours. They have stars in them that have lived and died, and elements that have been formed that can only happen after a supernova. Neon is one that was surprising to see in these early galaxies. Oxygen. And so now we've got to completely go back and try to understand how the first stars were formed and the life cycle of these early galaxies.
We're visiting with Dr. Scott Acton of Ball Aerospace. Scott, you embarked on a bicycle ride around the world to promote the James Webb Space Telescope. Tell me about that.
Yes, it's something I've always wanted to do. I've always felt like, you know, that if you want to call it as your purpose or whatever, that I was meant to bicycle around the world. And it's not something that happens automatically. In fact, there are all manner of things in life designed to keep a person from doing that. You know, children, mortgages, that sort of thing.
Wind and cold.
But I found myself, the cold, that's right. I found myself in a unique situation. I could sort of afford to take a year off from my job. The project could have me take a year off. My children were all off going to college. And although I was in my mid-50s, my body hadn't figured it out yet. And so I was still in pretty good physical shape. And so I decided to take this opportunity to do this bike ride. And I'd done a lot of bicycle touring before, and I find that some people can relate to the idea of why a person would want to go on a long journey by bicycle, but most people don't. So what do we do? We try to associate the ride with something else, like world peace. Well, world peace was already taken, so I decided to associate the ride with large space-based telescopes, namely the James Webb Space Telescope. So this became the James Webb Space Telescope World Bicycle Tour. Some people in NASA thought that was really, really great. Other people at NASA were horrified by the idea that I would do this and somehow link my personal activities to this telescope. But of course, that's all public domain. You know, there's nothing to prevent a person from doing that. And I set off to do this ride. I presume you want me to talk a little bit about some of the speed bumps that hit along the way, Craig.
But not necessarily, Scott. I just find it fascinating. But you were literally able to bicycle on several continents. You paused along the way to give talks. How did people receive you, I think, would be what I would want to know.
Yeah, it was interesting. In general, the reception was quite positive. As I went further north in North America, I would say the reception was colder. But, you know, just people tend to be more reserved, a little less friendly as you get further north. As I got to Eastern Europe, I noticed the same thing, too. They tend to be a little more reserved, a little more cautious about some weirdo showing up in a brightly colored bicycle outfit. But people everywhere were just absolutely thrilled with the fact that this was happening. Most people had never heard of the telescope. And, you know, and science is not for everybody, but everybody loves technology. And so the technology of this telescope was what I concentrated on in the lectures. And in particular, the kids, the children were really, really excited by it.
Scott, what is next for you? And I ask that in all seriousness with the thought that you reached a pinnacle in your career when so much effort and focus of your life came together in that one moment you knew everything was going to work. And maybe you exhaled, maybe you didn't, but now what's next?
Yeah, that's a very good question. I hope I don't offend anybody by using this example, but you know, back when you and I were going to college as freshmen, you walk into a classroom, you look around, and what do? Of course, you find the prettiest girl in there, and you sit down next to her. Okay. And I think that's a reasonable way to approach it. So I have, in my view, the most exciting work that is taking place on our planet is what SpaceX is doing with its attempts to put a rocket on Mars. And so I've made, some efforts to get involved with this. I think the timing might be a little bad right now. I still think because I don't actually know how to build rockets. You know, so if I had an opportunity to do that, that's what I would do. There are a lot of other very interesting things happening right now in the area. If I can avoid moving to Los Angeles, I will. I'll certainly do that. But that does seem to be where the really interesting stuff is taking place. And who knows? You know, gosh, the world record for the oldest person to bicycle around the world is 56.
Well,
man,
you're 1 year past that, Scott. You can do it now.
Oh, I'm way more than 1 year past it.
Of course we are.
I'm yeah.
Scott,
I could have done it on a unicycle at 56. So.
Scott, one of the most interesting things I've ever heard you say, we had a teacher in common in high school. Her name was Lois Sackman, and she was our speech and debate teacher. And I think it may surprise people to learn the value that you place on our speech class.
Yes. Yes, people assume that I would take, you know, my math or my science background. But the reality is when you choose to major in something, your first day of class, you're going to far exceed what you learned in junior high and high school in that topic. And the ability to stand in front of people and talk, to express myself and communicate is the most important thing I learned in high school. I think the second most important thing I learned in high school was the ability to just socialize and interact with people, which I learned in band. I would say band, sitting next to our mutual friend Steve, all those years was perhaps the most formative thing that I experienced in all my education. Communication and socialization, that's what you have to come away with in high school.
Dr. Scott Acton, your work on the James Webb Space Telescope is just amazing. It's just wonderful for you to recount the stories again to me. I hope someday we can sit next to one another at a solar eclipse, Scott, and enjoy that again.
That would be fun.
Dr. Scott Acton, a wavefront scientist with Ball Aerospace. Scott, thank you so much for joining us on Main Street.
Well, you're welcome, Craig.
That conversation first aired in February. And you know what's happening right now, don't you? It is our fall member drive. We are a nonprofit public radio station. That means our programs are, well, you should think of it like the honor system. We are here. We're airing this. You can hear it whether or not you have paid for it. So then we ask, are you the kind of person who can have a little extra money and pay for services like this so that everybody can listen? You know, I listened for years before I could afford to become a sustaining member, and that is because of the people who came before me. And so I think of my membership a little as paying it forward for the people who can't afford it just yet. So if you have the means, please consider joining this community of supporters who do have those financial means to make this possible. It sounds insane. We're just going to put it out there. And then if you want to pay for it, but you know, it works because people, for the most part, are good, honorable, honest, curious people who support the things that they enjoy. And now is the time to put the money where your virtues are by calling 800-359-4145 or making that investment at prairiepublic.org.
We do provide, Ashley, free services to not just a few folks, not just a few people who have paid to get behind the paywall,
yeah, right?
Et cetera, et cetera. We're available to everyone in the community. And that's why we ask that if you have the means, please consider joining in the community of supporters who support our station financially. There's a lot to support. We want to bring many, many stories of North Dakota and the Prairie region to you, our listeners. We do that by podcasting now. We do that by our shows like Main Street. We deliver the news every day. We have translators across the state that bring our strong signal to you. Or now you can listen to us on demand. We fit your schedule with all of what we bring from Prairie Public. We bring it to you. Some think that it's not a realistic model, maybe even impossible. But it is the public radio model.
It's been around for decades.
For a long time, and we depend on our listeners to pick up the phone, call us at 800-359-4145, or visit us online at prairiepublic.org. It takes just a moment. And as I said earlier, if you have the means, anything, any level of support, we are grateful for, and we would love to hear from you right now.
800-359-4145, or make that investment online at prairiepublic.org. And we want to hear from people across the state. We get people calling in from Dickinson, Bismarck, West Fargo, Thief River Falls. That's because we are a regional service here. We are looking to educate, involve, and inspire the people of the Prairie region. So you notice there's not a lot of mountains around here, not even a whole lot of forests,
really?
But prairie. Prairie. Yeah, you're coming from Wyoming. but prairie. We have got that prairie. And, you know, it was described to me once as you have to allow the prairie to reveal itself to you. It takes much more patience. It's reflective of who we are around here. We're a stoic bunch. It takes a little while to get to know us. But, hey, we're great people. We support services like this at 800-359-4145 or at prairiepublic.org.
This is Dakota Datebook for September 12th. The 1930s were a turbulent time in North Dakota's state government. Four men served as Chief Justice of the North Dakota Supreme Court during an 11-month period from December of 1932 to November of 1933. This was due to a ballot measure passed by voters in 1930. The measure lengthened justices' terms from 6 years to 10. Way back when, the justice who had the shortest remaining term served as Chief Justice. This led to some justices holding the chief's role multiple times as re-elections shuffled the remaining terms. The 1934 election had three Supreme Court seats on the ballot, so beginning in 1933, the two-year term of Chief Justice was evenly divided among the three incumbents, each taking the reins for an eight-month stint. To avoid a reoccurrence of this clunky situation, the 1934 election employed different term lengths for the three seats, 10 years, 8 years, and 6 years. Subsequent elections would return to 10-year terms, which would then be staggered. Also in 1934, the court's disqualification of Governor Bill Langer from office due to his federal felony conviction for corruption made the Supreme Court race a hot ticket. Justice Adolf Christensen's term as Chief Justice ended on the last day of 1932. Then, Justice William Neusel served as Chief Justice from January to September of 1933, followed by Justice Luther Birdsell, taking over when the court reconvened on this date in 1933. But Birdsell resigned shortly afterward to take a job as General Counsel for the newly formed Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation. Langer appointed District Judge George Mollring to replace Birdsell. Justice Alexander Burr then succeeded Birdsell as Chief Justice. Burr and Neusel won re-election in 1934. Former Attorney General James Morris won a Supreme Court seat, too. The Bismarck Tribune reported that the three winners had run on a non-political platform and were violently opposed in the race by Langer supporters. The court election was high profile because Burr and Neusel were in the majority of the court opinion that ousted Langer. Mollring, who lost the race and served only a year on the court, was the only dissenter in the Langer opinion. Today's Dakota Datebook was written by Jack Dura. I'm Merrill Pepcorn.
Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota, with funding from Humanities North Dakota.
This is Bird Note. Before the high-tech gadgets used to track bird migration today, a Louisiana ornithologist studied migration with one simple tool, a telescope aimed at the moon. George Lowry dreamed up moonwatching in the 1940s to prove that birds regularly migrated across the Gulf of Mexico. He knew you could see the silhouettes of migrating birds passing in front of the full moon through a telescope. Working with an astronomer, Lowry turned moonwatching counts into standardized measurements to compare the amount of migration at different places and times. On a ship docked on the coast of Yucatan, Lowry pointed his telescope out over the Gulf. He calculated that 3,700 birds crossed an imaginary one-mile line on the water every hour. Then, in the 1950s, he organized the first continent-wide survey of migration patterns with thousands of volunteers across North America. Moonwatching became obsolete once scientists began using radar to monitor migration. But you can still point a telescope at the moon and see those flickering silhouettes of birds on the move. Learn more about the history of bird migration research in Rebecca Heisman's new book, Flight Paths, How a Passionate and Quirky Group of Pioneering Scientists Solved the Mystery of Bird Migration. For Bird Note, I'm Michael Stein.
Nearly a million people have fled the civil war in Sudan into neighboring countries.
They enter our home by gun, frighten the women, and force it to leave my house.
The UN meets next week, and the U.S. ambassador has a tall order: find solutions for Sudan. On the next Morning Edition from NPR News.
Starting at 4 a.m. Central, right here on Prairie Public.
So during this fall member drive, this is when we are asking you to support this essential news source with your financial investment. Reporting, okay, yeah, you could make an argument that you could put a voice memo on your iPhone and that would make you a reporter. You technically are recording this information.
You're the queen of doing that, by the way.
That is. I have actually never done that.
You always give yourself memos from your iPhone.
Oh, yeah, but I don't call that journalism.
Okay.
I gotcha. I thought you were saying I record my interviews
that.
No, I just give myself reminders because I have three jobs and I need that kind of thing. But, you know, that is the tool of the trade, yes, but that isn't the understanding. That isn't the nuance. That isn't the ethics. That isn't looking at all sides of a story and getting that information fact-checked and put out there in a way that other people can digest it and understand it and realize why it's important to know. It takes people. Yes, I've been learning some AI software to cut some ums out of some interviews, and I love it. It's fantastic. But you still need people who understand people. That's kind of our thing.
People and also, actually, we've got a lot of sophisticated equipment here, a network of equipment that brings stories to you. After we do the people interaction, that's like the first slice of the pie that we've talked about in this pledge break before. Then we have to cut it all up and make it presentable and then get it on air, get it on a podcast, make it available for streaming and to do all of those things. So that's why we're asking people for their support. Support us at prairiepublic.org. You can pledge whatever you can afford, or give us a call at 800-359-4145. Consider pledging right now. We would love to hear from you.
And that is absolutely true. The phone lines are open, 800-359-4145. Or as always, you can make your investment at prairiepublic.org. A lot of people have different ideas of success, whether it means a lot of money or you have a second home or you have a good work-life balance. Our definition of successful radio is that it's news and information that you need to know and why you need to know it. So again, finding out what's going on and then letting you know why that matters. 800-359-4145 or prairiepublic.org. What's coming up tomorrow?
Ashley, first of all, it's been great pitching with you today and asking our listeners to support us. We have two of our favorite interviews from early this year. One of my favorites is with author Bill Vossler. He wrote a memoir called Days of Wonder, and he talks about his childhood living in North Dakota. And it's an imaginative story. Comes from maybe a little bit of a troubled childhood as well, but I found it to be fascinating. And we'll also learn about Bison Strides, a wonderful program that uses horse therapy for people with various challenges. That's coming up tomorrow on Main Street, and we hope you'll join us.